Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to an extra special spooky episode of Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, the podcast where we watch every single film in the collective Coppola family filmography to determine, are they the greatest film family of all time? Halloween may be over once more for another year, but like the tagline of today's film, love never dies, and neither does spooky season. So yeah, we're keeping the spooktacular train rolling with Francis Ford Coppola's 1992 horny horror classic, Bram Stoker's Dracula. And as is ever that is the case, I have a guest joining me to help me determine, does this film help staple the Coppolas against the cross as the greatest film family of all time, or do they deserve to be staked through the heart as evil against Hollywood? And the guest this week is James Rodriguez, who you may know from Invasion of the Potty People, a monthly podcast from Not Just for Kids podcast, or yeah, some of his film writing and such. So yeah, this one was a lot of fun. Could have happily have talked about this film for hours upon hours upon hours. It's kind of just getting into the production and the way that this film is made is enough to just get lost down a rabbit hole. But there's plenty of chat and plenty of fun. We do spoil this movie, as is ever the case. But I guess all we've got left to do is make some Coppola connections. You join us this lonely and cold October evening in a castle situated in the Carpathian Mountains as we discuss the 1992 adaptation of Bram Stoker's iconic horror novel. It is, of course, Francis Ford Coppola's dark, erotic, nightmare, gothic horror, Bram Stoker's Dracula, adapted to the screen by James V. Hart and directed by Big Daddy Francis himself. The film stars Gary Oldman, Winona Ryder, Keanu Reeves, Anthony Hopkins, Sadie Frost, Richard E. Grant, Cary Elwes, Billy Campbell, and Tom Waits. And apart from Francis, we have another Coppola connection in this film. We have his eldest son, Roman Coppola, who is the second unit director and somewhat like effects supervisor on this film. Official credits are a bit muddy on that, but I'm sure we'll get into his involvement in this conversation. But trapped inside this Transylvanian castle alongside me, looking for a way out and helping me answer the ultimate question, if the Coppolas are the greatest film family of all time, is writer and podcaster James Rodriguez. James, do you renounce God?
Oh, I can't renounce something I never was a part of anyway. tonight I'm going to.
Amazing. How are you? Are you well?
Yes, I am particularly well this evening. I'm feeling quite spooky for this chat, which is about to unfold. And I'm excited. It's a good one.
Yes, yes. A lot to talk about with this film. It's I'm going to hold my chest close to my chest and not kind of, I could get carried away and dive into talking about this film immediately, but we've got a little bit of housekeeping to do before we get to that. And as we do at the start of this podcast all the time, is I like to ask my guests a simple question. When did you become aware of the Coppola family? Was there an entry point, like a person? And then when did you kind of realize there is this kind of like vampiric Dracula-esque lineage that they have?
Okay, so like any burgeoning film fan, I was aware of Francis as I grew up. How could you not be with The Godfather and Apocalypse Now, like everywhere in a conversation? And I was also aware he had a daughter, Sophia, who appeared in Godfather Part 3 and also got her own directing career. I knew there was Gia was making films also, and I did become aware Nicolas Cage was a part of that lineage. But I must admit, I had no idea how massive a family tree it was until you and your podcast made me aware. So it's all down to you.
Oh, I'm doing a service to people. I like to feel like even people I deem as hardened film fans are learning. Even yesterday, somebody messaged me saying, I did not realize Jason Schwartzman was a part of this family. And I'm like, welcome to the club. Like, welcome. There's weird and wonderful connections throughout this family. And I never besmirch anyone for not knowing like the knowledge I know on the Coppola family. Because, hey, if people are going to get involved and learn about them, come along for the ride. Like, learn as I learn. Have you ever met a Coppola, James? Oh, no. Actually, what was that first? Do you remember? Actually, no, you said Francis was your entry point. I don't want to. We'll get to what your first Francis film was in a moment. But have you ever met a Coppola?
Not that I know of, but to be honest, there's so many in the family. I may have met one without realizing. For all I know, I stood in a queue and Jackie Coppola or Thomas Coppola or someone was right in front of me, for all I know. It's, I suppose, don't know until you actually realise, but for now I'd like to think, sure, I met one and I didn't know.
Okay. I guess if you kind of, I don't know, are in central London, any major city long enough, you'll bump into one of them. For sure. So you mentioned Francis was your entry point to the family. I must ask you, what would have been the first Francis Ford Coppola film you would have actually seen? You obviously talked about an awareness of his films and especially that kind of 70s run, but how old were you when you first kind of, I don't know, watched one of his films, and what was that film?
It's fascinating the amount of films Francis Ford Coppola is known for, and the very first film I ever saw was as a young boy when Jack was on the TV, which is an interesting entry point. It's mm-hmm. an odd film to look back on.
Yes,
but yeah, I can't deny it wasn't The Godfather, it wasn't The Conversation, it wasn't any of his big hitters. It was Robin Williams as a 10-year-old boy.
Have you revisited that film at all in later life?
No. Maybe if I decide to do a Coppola deep dive, because I have a lot of blind spots in his filmography, then I'll revisit it. But for now, it's just that odd film I watched as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm dreading the day I have to cover it, because I fear it will not hold up at all. I remember vividly enjoying it as a kid, but I think that's just the novelty of a kid who grew up too quick and kind of got to live in two worlds of being an adult and being a child at the same time. But I don't know. Yeah, I guess that's what a lot of us with, I don't know, maybe I'm speaking for myself here. what we want, right? We want to look like adults, but still get away with the things we're doing as kids. We want to be like, we want no consequences for our actions, and we want to just be able to, it'll be fine. Someone else will deal with that. So let's get extra spooky, ooky, ooky with it, and let's talk about Bram Stoker's Dracula. But before we do, let's have a little listen to the trailer.
Here occurred the frightening and shocking history of Prince Dracula and the woman he loved.
I have crossed oceans of time to find you.
Yeah. Dracula.
There's a sinister, darker side to him. I find irresistible. I've never met any man with such a passion for life. He is unlike any man.
What are you?
Vampires do exist. This one we fight, this one we face. Can take on many forms. He is both young and old. He can appear as mist, as vapor, as the fog. And he can vanish at will.
Oh, my love.
The power of his evil desire has no end.
You've got to go to him. And you've got to love him.
She is a willing recruit, a devoted disciple. She is the devil's concubine. Dagger!
Join me. In eternal life.
Your salvation is his destruction.
I want to be what you are. I want to see what you see. I want to love what you love.
Take me away from all this death.
Make no mistake, he must be stopped.
So this film was released November 13th, 1992. So we are fast approaching its 30th anniversary. Made on a budget of $40 million and made a box office return of $215.9 million. So very much a win for Francis Ford Coppola during maybe a, some would say, following a rough patch in his career. So there's that. But James, do you mind taking the duty of telling us what Bram Stoker's Dracula is all about?
Bram Stoker's Dracula is adapted from the classic 1897 novel Dracula by Bram Stoker. So that makes sense of the title. And it's about young Jonathan Harker, an estate agent, I believe, who's looking to do business, get a promotion and do business with a creepy figure called Count Dracula. But Dracula has his own designs on Jonathan's bride, Mina, and she bears a striking resemblance to his long-lost love, Elisabetta. So he sets out to woo her in his own ways, no matter who he has to slaughter to get.
Well, that is a brilliant setup. That is a that is kind of the nuts and bolts of the setup of this film. But it is so much more than that. It takes twists and turns and goes into weird and wonderful places, and kind of is like this beautiful encapsulation of 20th century cinema techniques and kind of, I don't know, everything that's done in this melange. So When did you first see this film? Did you, I imagine you're a similar age to me, so wouldn't have seen it on first run, but what are your kind of memories of it growing up? And like, did you see it quite young, or did you come to it later on?
Well, I didn't see this at the time of release, because on the day it was released, I was 10 days old.
Lovely stuff.
Which would have made it difficult, but not impossible. I'd like to take you back to a faraway time when I first saw this. It was 13 days ago when it was re-released in cinemas, and that was literally the first time I saw this film ever. And it was something which I knew of through pop culture, particularly the Simpsons Treehouse of Horror parody. Ooh, super fun, happy death slide! And I chose this because it felt like a big blind spot of mine, which I heard so much about. And I'm a fan of vampires, and I really wanted to discuss this. So I thought, why not? Let's finally get that sucker watched.
Pun intended, I'm assuming. If obviously this was your first time, how, like, what were your kind of relationship to the tellings of the Dracula story? Like, had you read Bram Stoker's book? Had, like, what kind of film adaptations had you dived into before getting to this one?
Okay, adaptations of Dracula wise, well, I have read Bram Stoker's book. I finished that earlier this year. But I'll be honest with you, it took me a while because the book has ebbs and flows with my interest, particularly in that middle section. It just lost me a bit, and it just became a book which I put off finishing.
But, well, can you tell us about the
stubborn, so I made my way through.
What is the format of that book? Because it's quite, it's obviously, I think it's translated onto the screen quite well, but it's if I'm remembering correctly, it's told in like diary entries, right?
Yes, exactly. It's told through the perspective of many characters. There's Mina, there's Jonathan Harker, Abraham Van Helsing, I believe Sir Arthur Homewood, and
James Sewer as well, the Doctor.
Yeah. Through their diary entries. Yeah, there's quite a few diary entries, and that's translated onto the screen, and it feels like it comes from such a place of reverence, which Coppola has for the original novel. When he was working as a camp counselor, he used to get the boys in their bunks and read it to them in its entirety, which must have been, a long night. But it's just fascinating how much he was really intrigued by that book. I mean, there's the popular story that at the first cast meeting, all of the principal cast read the entire novel out loud to get a feel for the story, which Sir Anthony Hopkins says took 2 whole days to complete. But it's all translated to screen well. It's like, it feels like it comes from a real place of love.
Yeah, and I think it's like to that point of them reading the novel aloud. Francis Ford Coppola just has this thing he does with a lot of his all of his casts, is he rehearses with them. I'm not sure whether he's still doing it nowadays. I know he's like just started filming on Megaropolis, his newest film, whether he took the people away for a couple of weeks. But yeah, they spent 2 weeks at his like Napa Valley estate and kind of like played games, like acting games, and kind of like improvised the scenes and really chewed upon, like, got everyone to, as you said, read the book kind of in a, like a round table like format. And his like reasoning is like, I want, as early on in production, for people, if they're going to have those epiphanies, what this kind of film is all about or what it is for them, I want them to have it nice and like early doors. I don't want it to be like halfway through and they're still like, what is my character's motivation? Like, why is this? So I think an exercise like reading the book together, and especially in that way that it is, I would imagine he would have got the cast members who were assigned to the different characters to read their like diary entries. So that must have some like insight that, yeah, like they can internalize some of that to make their characters, I don't know, a lot more embodied and well-rounded than it would be just to be like, yeah, this is what we're going to do. And there's a lot of stuff of this film as well that's, I don't know, I think there's close to like 30 minutes of kind of like deleted and like extended scenes and stuff like that. So yeah, there is a bit more to this. And so is it, yeah, in regards to my initial question, what were the other adaptations of Dracula that you on screen that you had seen?
Well, I had seen the Bela Lugosi version and the Christopher Lee version. I'd also seen Dario Argento's Dracula 3D, which if you want a version of Dracula to watch, not that one. It somehow makes Dracula turning into a giant praying mantis boring.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's a feat in its own right. I'd also seen Nosferatu, which is the unofficial Dracula adaptation, which was phenomenal in its own right. I think those are the main ones I've seen, actual adaptations of the novel. Oh, I suppose Dracula Dead and Loving It as well. But that's more a spoof of this 92 film than the novel itself.
Yeah. So what, how do you feel like that? Let's get this out of the way. Like, of the kind of adaptations you've watched, like, which is the most faithful to the novel itself? Is it this one? Is this the one that kind of nails it? Obviously it's baked into the title, right? This is Bram Stoker's Dracula. This isn't just another Dracula tale.
In regarding to, let's say, the big mainstream adaptations, it must be the most faithful. It feels like it takes it. Well, it adapts the diary elements. It goes with the idea of Dracula begins as a white-haired old man who grows more youthful as he drinks more and more blood. And it goes against traditional expectations of vampires, like Dracula's able to move in the sunlight. Mm-hmm. It feels like Coppola is adhering to the novel with reverence, but he's not shackled by it. He puts his own spin on it by also including, say, the opening, where it goes into the history of Vlad, the man who would become Count Dracula. And it's phenomenal the way he marries those two for this film.
Mm-hmm. And I think some of it's got to, obviously, yeah, some of it's got to be put on the shoulders of James V. Hart as well, the script writer for this film. And this is an interesting one, how this kind of fell onto Francis Ford Coppola's lap as well. It was actually like a chance, a planned meeting he had with Winona Ryder, because she was supposed to star as Mary Corleone in The Godfather Part 3. And I think they just had a meeting to kind of, I don't know, clear the air, squash the beef, just in case there's any bad blood, because she left the project quite late on. And on departure, she said to Francis, like, oh yeah, by the way, like, do you want to look at this script? And he's like, kind of thing. And he said, yeah, it's Dracula. And she said, like, she saw his, like, kind of eyes light up. Like you kind of said earlier, it's something that he absolutely adored and, like, was fascinated by. And he's openly said there's great kind of behind-the-scenes footage on the Blu-ray of this where he goes into the fact that a lot of the other adaptations are really fast and loose with the novel, like, even, like, down to, like, it's whatever suits. Like, all of a sudden, Lucy is Jonathan Harker's, like, wife. Like, this person, like, there's characters who are completely omitted and stuff like that. And I think Anthony Hopkins said, like, what's great about having all of the characters there is you realise that they're kind of all different sides of the same coin. They're all obsessed, like how Dracula's obsessed with Mina. They're all obsessed about something, and it's kind of, you need that ensemble to really, really drive that aspect home. And yeah, from my reading, obviously, like, I don't have time to go watch every single Dracula adaptation, but from what I've kind of read and gleaned from other places, this very much is like the kind of most faithful adaptation to the book. It's got to be, right? The title itself is Bram Stoker's Dracula. Like, that's a ballsy move. That's kind of going, this ain't just Dracula. Like, this is the book come to the screen. So what were your thoughts? Yeah, obviously you watched this 13 days ago. What were your like kind of like thoughts? Did you have any expectations going into this film at all?
I don't know what I was expecting, really. I just thought it's a film that was massive for so long. It's a Francis Ford Coppola film, so I expected it to at least be some form of a work of art. And what I received in the experience was something so sensual and poetic. It felt like it was made by a romantic soul from very real places of love. And
I think you can argue that is Francis Ford Coppola. I think if you strip back the violence of The Godfather, it's somebody who kind of has a romantic edge. He loves family and stuff like that. The kind of beating heart for a lot of his films is family. Like, he obviously met, yeah, he's had these wild follies, whether it is Apocalypse Now and stuff like that. But yeah, I think if you kind of peel the layers back of the guy, he's an old romantic at heart.
That's very fair, I suppose. But with that, I was also surprised at how it's a film that managed to be quite horrific and very horny at the centre of it.
Oh yeah, this is a big old horn dog film. I absolutely love it for that. Like, this is like, I'm trying to think. I like, because my like early memories of this film, that kind of poster artwork, that original artwork for this, it's like ingrained in my brain. Like, I remember seeing it as a kid, like being like, whoa, what is that? Like, it almost looks like Tombstone-esque, and like the Dracula, like, written in blood. And I was like, oh, what is that? Whether it's like seeing it in the video shop, do you know what I mean, on a higher shelf, being like, I'd kind of cower away from it and stuff like that. Do you have like any, do you remember it kind of being out in the world when you were growing up and kind of see like any, like, I don't know, reactions to that artwork, or ever having glimpses of it on TV or anything?
The artwork was very ingrained in my memory. It's definitely one of those posters which I seem to remember being around, like maybe from the video, in seeing the video in Blockbuster on the shelf, but it's also Gary Oldman himself, just the image of him either with the long black hair and the sunglasses and the top hat, like he's some 19th century slash wannabe, or the big red kimono and the extravagant hairstyle that looks like he's modeled it after a pair of breasts. It just feels like whichever image of Gary Oldman, it feels like that's been a massive pop culture element that just persevered for a while. And in some ways, it feels like the last truly iconic take on Count Dracula. After Gary Oldman, who is there? Probably Adam Sandler in Hotel Transylvania would have been the closest.
Luke Evans in Dracula Untold. Luke.
Forgot that existed, in all honesty.
Yeah, which has been covered here on this podcast. Has a Coppola connection, that film. So that has been discussed on this very here podcast. It's not a good film.
Didn't look it.
So let's talk about, let's dive into the cast of this film, because there's a lot to talk about in that cast. let's get him out of the way. Big old Keanu Reeves. What did you make of Keanu Reeves in this film and that wandering accent of his?
I like Keanu Reeves, but, oh, poor Keanu. He just feels so miscast here. And it doesn't help that Jonathan Harker doesn't tend to be the most engaging character in Dracula, but Keanu, his accent wanders across the pond, across centuries. It feels like he's struggling a bit with that. And Coppola's been open that he needed a hot young star to connect with the female filmgoers. And I don't begrudge him for casting Keanu, but it just didn't work in my eyes, and it's a shame.
Well, what do you think of the fact that, like, Christian Slater was offered the role and turned it down? Would he have been better or worse as Jonathan Harker?
Ooh. Christian Slater, that's not a bad idea, actually. I don't know what his British accent's like, but I don't know. I feel like when you see Christian Slater, he can input, like, a kind of danger or bad boy in his performance, which kind of gives him a bit of an edge. And I don't know, maybe that could have helped with, but I like the idea, but I don't know if he would have measured up is the only thing, because you can only theorize on so much.
Yeah, what would have been great is obviously if that role had gone to, like, an unknown, I could imagine someone great like Tim Roth, like, fitting into that. Jonathan, get somebody who can handle the accent, do you know what I mean? Like, he is British after all. And he's proved in, he'll do a hokey American accent elsewhere. Reservoir Dogs. Keanu Reeves in this, it's kind of, there is a moment particularly when he sees Dracula. When he returns to London, he basically sounds like his Bill and Ted character when he's like, "Whoa, it's the same dude." You might as well be like, "Whoa, it's the same dude, but he's younger." Like, there is so much kind of, it's like he couldn't shake off that Californian twang for this film at all. Like, at times, and I don't, bless him. Bless him. Bless Winona Ryder as well. Because, yeah, what do you think of Winona Ryder's accent in this?
I heard a bit about Winona Ryder's accent going before this film, much as I did Keanu. But maybe it's just because with Keanu, I was like, it's one thing to hear about it and another thing to hear it in the wild, to hear him just go, "I know where the bastard sleeps." But I didn't think Winona's, herself was that bad. I mean, I think she fit the role well of is someone who wishes to be adored as her best friend is, who seems disgusted at such images of carnal pleasures. But when Vlad pays her attention, lavishes her with such adoration, it seems to awake a longing inside her. And I think Ryder plays that really well. And it's funny how the film essentially turns into, feels like a love triangle, with Jonathan being the safe option and Vlad is the bad boy.
Yeah.
And it's the romantic at heart.
Here's a question I've got on my notes here, which is Jonathan Harker the original cuck?
I suppose someone had to be. I suppose...
Because he probably gets cuckolded in this, doesn't he?
I could see that.
He just gets kind of like sidelined, where she's like,
"Yeah,
Like, by the end, they're married, and she's like, no, I must be with Dracula. And it's like, oh, no, you've literally just come back to London, and she's running away with another man. So, yeah, we've got the accents out of the way. I felt like that was something we needed to tick off nice and early. So, yeah, back to that cast. So, Gary Oldman. Mm-hmm. I personally think Gary Oldman is phenomenal in this film. Like, the way that kind of, even amongst all of that kind of prosthesis, and he's under a lot of prosthesis throughout this. There's an amazing moment of him in the behind-the-scenes footage where he kind of, like, starts to talk about all of the different makeups he's in throughout the film and all the different versions of Dracula he has to play. He's like, I'm kind of... like really old Dracula. I'm kind of decrepit Dracula. I'm the one in the castle. I'm Wolf Dracula. I'm Vapor Dracula. I'm a Body of Rats Dracula. I'm Bat Dracula. I'm all of these. And like he said as well, like he found this one of, I guess around the time, found it the most physically demanding role he had ever done, because it's just so much like putting stuff on and kind of getting under all of this kind of gloop and goo to play the part. But what is amazing, I think, about Gary Oldman in this is you can see, like, not in the way of like it's bad prosthetics and that, you can see it's still a person under there. It feels like when you first meet Dracula, Jonathan Harker does, obviously we meet him earlier on in the film, but when we first meet Dracula, all caps Dracula, he's living, he's breathing. Like you would hate to be touched by those like decrepit old fingers and stuff like that. Like you almost recoil. Like I just think, and like he plays it so, I tell you, he's tonally, I think throughout this film, I think everyone seems to be like on the same page of what the brief is. Do you know what I mean? They're all kind of like, this is the tone of the film and we're going to nail it. And Gary Oldman does absolutely nail it. Is there like standout moments for you of Gary Oldman's performance? What do you make of it as a whole as well?
He's phenomenal. It's no wonder so many people took to him. For one, look at him when he's younger. Holy shit. Coppola didn't need Reeves to capture that, the female perspective, as he wanted. Because fucking hell, Oldman is a babe as a younger Dracula. What? But it's not just that. It's that he gives a phenomenal presence, and he hired a singing coach to help him lower his voice by an octave because he wanted Dracula to have a more sinister quality. Mm-hmm. And it works. You hear his playful laugh when he's seeing how Jonathan Harker's reacting to Dracula's bride feasting on that baby.
Yeah.
Or the pauses Dracula takes when he's emphasizing specific words for dramatic effect.
Uh-huh.
He's a man that's having a bit of fun with his bloody business. And yes, he's under a lot of prosthetics, which is phenomenal, by the way. Coppola was insistent to not use any elaborate special effects or computer trickery, and that works because it holds up extremely well. But Oldman's performance really shines through it all. I remember when For the Dark World came out and Christopher Eccleston was the villainous role in that film, and he said acting under prosthetics was like washing your feet with your socks on. And you get none of that from Oldman's performance, because it's like he's wearing essentially the prosthetics as a second skin, and he's not letting it inhibit what kind of performance he's got to put.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah. Dracula. And I know that him and Coppola at times didn't see eye to eye, but was like really like Oldman was kind of like, I kind of like it. It's like, we don't. It's like, I kind of want what I want. Like, he wants what he wants. Like, then again, there's great kind of footage of them like butting heads and stuff like that. And they're kind of like duking it out. And Oldman found it really hard in that kind of armor he has to wear at the beginning of the film as well. And like, he said, like, I can hardly fucking walk in this. And then just got to a point, he's like, you know what? I don't care if I kind of like damage the suit. I'm just gonna act now. I'm just going to like do what I need to do. Like, because at this moment, it feels like the suit is wearing me, and it shouldn't feel like that. It should. I should be wearing it, and like kind of yeah. Then kind of brings it to life. And this is a, I don't know, like an interesting point in like Gary Oldman's career, right? Because he kind of wasn't massive yet, and it's kind of like, from, I don't know, he'd kind of been in a lot of like British stuff, do you know what I mean? Or like he'd been Sid Vicious and Sid and Nancy. He'd kind of quite au fait with the bad boy, I would say. And yeah, I think he just kind of, considering like somebody could, this feels like a role that somebody could get lost in their own arse up, do you know what I mean? Like, I could look at a recent
Jared Leto.
Yeah, somebody who has played a vampire very recently and kind of decided to fuck shit up,
to suck.
Yeah, whereas Gary Oldman, again, was that pun intended there, I'm assuming, James?
Hell yeah.
Whereas here, yeah, Gary Oldman kind of, and he gets the romanticism. Like, he has openly said, there is a line in this film that he read and was like, I want to do the film on that basis. And it's when he says to Mina, I've crossed oceans of time to find you. And like, he's like, the fact I get to say that to someone, I'm doing this film. And it's like, gotta give it up to you, Gary. And it's really fascinating watching footage of him like behind the scenes, because he like shaved the front of his hair so his hairline, obviously, like when he's Dracula, he's kind of got the mad hairline, but yeah, like in some of the behind the scenes stuff, maybe like it hasn't been shaved yet, like, so it's a bit stubbly at the front of his head and stuff like that. Let's kind of like whip through the rest of the cast, because I feel like we could be here all night kind of just discussing the cast. Obviously, there's a couple I feel like we might need to give a little bit of breathing time, but we can kind of jump back into some of them, and they'll get their shine when we kind of talk about specific scenes and stuff like that. But I guess the one person we really have to mention here is Anthony Hopkins, somebody who I think is like the MVP of this film. I think Anthony Hopkins like is having a fucking ball, and I don't know why. So many times, like, I've kind of watched this in quick succession a few times this year, but there was a big gap in my watching history of this film, and maybe like last year I watched it again. And I'd kind of forgotten that Anthony Hopkins is in this film. And then like when he appeared, I was like, fucking hell. And like when he's on screen, he kind of takes the air out of the room in like the best kind of way. It's kind of like, oh, it's the Anthony Hopkins show now. Yeah, what do you make of his performance as a Professor Abraham Van Helsing?
I quite like his take on Abraham and Van Helsing. He's the man of medicine who takes it seriously, but he's also as serious about matters of the unknown. And it constantly feels like the character's teetering on the edge of sanity. And while he's not smoothing down the edges, it's like when Mina's being asked about Lucy's death, and he's very blunt about, oh yeah, she suffered, absolutely. And it's a funny moment, but it's also that he gets right down to this iteration of how he's just business first, and he's absolutely going to ensure that it gets done as greatly as he can, because he's not there to waste time just smoothing down the edges for the people to ask. He's just gonna go right in there. And
yeah,
I don't blame Anthony Hopkins for having a ball in this role, because just the year before he won the Oscar for Silence of the Lambs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose you'd be having a ball at if the same thing happened.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't, like, he's really interesting as well, because he said, like, he found Coppola's approach. He said, like, when they were rehearsing and stuff like that, like, he said he'd come from, like, the British stage and, like, the British films, stuff like that, where there's, like, foundations for everything, and everything's kind of really, like, mapped out. And he said, like, when he kind of got to the rehearsal stage, Coppola, they were still kind of working stuff out. Like, Coppola, like, famously said to everyone, like, you all know the book. Is there stuff in the book that we're missing? Like, if so, let us know, and we'll kind of add it to the script. And, like, he was really open to suggestions. It was like Anthony Hopkins' suggestion that when Van Helsing first meets Mina, that he, like, grab her and dance with her. And there's, again, great footage of that happening for I'd imagine the first time, and, like, Francis Ford Coppola's eyes lighting up, and it's like, oh yeah, I'm kind of getting to play with somebody who, like, kind of gets it. Like, we kind of want to make this the best thing it can be. And, like, Anthony Hopkins seemed really game for that. And, like, that's what I'd say about his performance. It's very, like, it's very game. And I'm not sure how it was in the screening you went to, because I recently saw this in the cinema as well. It's like his line deliveries got, like, laughs in the screening I was in. I think one in particular is at Lucy's wake, and he's speaking to Richard E. Grant's character, and says, he says, like, get your autopsy knives. He's like, what? We're doing an autopsy tonight? And he's like, no, we're going to cut her head off and put a stake through her heart. And, like, everyone in the screening I was in absolutely lost their minds for that one. I was like, oh yeah, it's kind of interesting watching with an audience going, yeah, that is actually, there are actually some laughs in this movie as well.
Mm, yeah, that was the biggest laugh in my screening as well. I think there was also a few when he's just being blunt at dinner with Lucy about how Mina suffered. No, he's at the dinner with Mina about how Lucy suffered, where before Keanu Reeves goes, "Doctor, please."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about, yeah, obviously we're kind of skirting around some of the scenes in this. What are kind of some of the standout scenes and set pieces? Because this is very, like, set piece heavy, right? There's a lot to chew over and, like, a lot to marvel at. And considering this film is 30 years old, it kind of, there's something about the filmmaking, and like we touched on earlier with you saying, like, they steer away from kind of effects in the kind of way that they would have been done at the time, leaning towards digital and stuff like that. Like, this is very much old timey, almost like, I don't know, like early era cinema stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like, you got, like, rear projection, false perspective, kind of any tricks they could kind of pull out of the bag. Do you know what I mean? Matte painting, matte boxes, all types of front projection, rear, all the kind of everything you can do. They were kind of like, let's kind of throw it at this film. But yeah, like, what are some of the scenes that kind of stand out to you when you think of this film?
The first one which really stands out for me was the opening prologue recounting Vlad's bloody history. And you've got the skylines which look hand painted, and it looks like it's a puppet show going on, as they use shadows and dolls to show essentially all the impaling that Vlad did.
Yeah,
particularly one which looks like Nosferatu in the background.
Yeah, that stuff's really great. I love that kind of silhouetted sequence at the beginning. Like, and I think, again, like, this film was, like, it's really fascinating to the way that they kind of they storyboarded this film absolutely, like, out the wazoo, kind of came across that idea in the storyboarding, like, oh, we'll do it like this. And a fantastic storyboard artist, Peter Ramsey, was working like really like closely with Roman Coppola, who kind of knew as well when he was kind of coming up with the ideas of how shot like things would be. He would kind of be knowing practically how that was going to be done, like in regards to the effects they would use, like whether it is, or yeah, like the dissolves they'd use. Like there's that great great moment where it kind of goes from Mina's eye to a glass of like absinthe, and there's the peacock feather into the tunnel and stuff like that. Like Roman Coppola was kind of like on top of all of that whilst they're coming at the storyboards. But I don't know, there's something to the idea of like kabuki theater to this film, in like in the way that kabuki theater will use any aspect of the kind of staging for a production to tell the story. And it feels like this film, more than many I can think of, does that in the way that like the costume design is telling a story, telling a part. Do you know what I mean? If that needs to tell part of the story, it will. The sets, the kind of the lighting, the music, the effects and stuff like that, like the kind of, yeah, or the cameras that are even used will be a part of the storytelling. Like everything feels like it's kind of in service of the plot and the story, and it all makes sense. And what's great about that sequence you mentioned as well is when Peter Ramsey spoke to this, is he felt that kind of silhouetted sequence really brings the audience into the world that Coppola's like created for this film, and that like he's kind of setting the template of like, this isn't like the real world. This is kind of this sub fantasy kind of like, I don't know. Yeah, as Coppola like said, it's this kind of dark, erotic nightmare world that he's created. And I think that sequence at the beginning, like you mentioned, is really brings us into what this film is going to be. And I think I've seen people like pull out like just single frames of that silhouetted sequence, and it's like you could hang that on your wall. It looks so beautiful. Like it's such a beautiful looking film. What other moments or kind of I could just gush over this film, James. You've got me going now.
I don't blame you. What you said about this erotic nightmare reminds me of the scene when I believe it's in Jack's room in the asylum, and Dracula and Mina are in an embrace, and Mina's begging Dracula to free her from all this death, and he's reluctant because, well, he knows the curse of the life he lives, and he doesn't want to inflict that upon her, but she begs and begs, and it's quite an erotically charged moment, particularly when Mina is just drinking from the wound Dracula makes. And then when all the guys walk into the room and Dracula has turned into that giant bat monster, it's phenomenally horrific. And it has my favorite moment in the film when he's the bat monster. He moves into the shadows and no cuts, the light is shone, and his body's been replaced by all those rats just in the same position. And it's such an effective moment. And when I saw that in the cinema, I was, as soon as he moved into the shadows, I was just like, oh God, what's going to happen now? And then as soon as the rats came on, I was like, oh my God, that's gross. I love it.
How did that? Because it's like, there's probably like one traditional jump scare in this, and it's when they first enter the room and you see that bat face just kind of like burst onto the screen. Did that get you, or did that, like, did you see a reaction in the screening you were into that at all?
I don't think I saw a reaction from other audience members, but it did make me jump because see Mina just on her own, as I was just wondering, like, wait, are we looking in the mirror or something? And then the bat face just comes up. I was like, oh shit.
That sequence is really great. And there is a technique, or there's a fit, like Francis Ford Coppola, they were kind of figuring out that literally on set, like how that scene was going to play out for some of it. And what they got Gary Oldman to do to kind of set the tone is they blindfolded everyone in the room. And then Gary Oldman was just given license to like whisper dark things in their ears to make everyone feel unsettled. And like Gary Oldman's in an interview going like, oh, like you don't do that. You don't do that with me. Like, I'm going to relish that opportunity. Like, and they've all gone on record being like, yeah, he was saying like some unrepeatable things to us. Like, you cannot repeat like the things that Gary Oldman was saying, because they were like, they were dark as fuck. But it's that is great. Like the kind of confrontation between him and Van Helsing, and like there's that great line, isn't there? Where he's like, because Van Helsing's going on about God and kind of like flashing his cross at him, and he bursts it into flames and trying to, he's like, look what your God has done to me. And it's like, yeah, like, and back to that kind of first moment you talk about of the kind of erotically charged like sequence. The film like almost like shifts at that point, and you kind of like, I don't know, there's a thing of like, you have that like revelation where it's like, I've secretly been rooting for this Mina Dracula relationship in a weird way. And it's kind of like all of that empathy and pathos kind of comes out in that moment towards his character specifically, because he's so like, it's like he is cursed at the end of the day. It's kind of like, he did this. Yeah, he kind of, and I don't quite get how he, like, even though this film does have that prologue, still don't quite understand how he became a vampire. Because it's just like, what did he choose by renouncing God? Like, is that how you do it? Is that how you become the first vampire? You just renounce God and stab a sword into a cross, and like it will bleed. Like, I don't quite know, but I'm here for it at the same time.
I suppose crosses don't tend to bleed, so I suppose that's the workaround for. It's not like any of us can renounce God, so I suppose that's what set it apart for Dracula to be this undead creature of the night.
Yeah, that's true. So, any other scenes that really stick in your mind that we haven't discussed, or I don't know, any particular characters?
I really like the sequence when Van Helsing takes all the guys to go into Lucy's resting place, but she's not in the coffin, and she comes down, and they. It's, for me, it's the bit where she's getting back into the coffin, which it was a shot that was actually filmed in reverse. Yeah. So they filmed her getting out of the coffin, but played it so it was happening backwards. And it adds this really eerie and unnatural quality that really creeps me out. And I think it works extremely well how it's also got just Lucy vomiting that blood, and then it's just ending with her getting decapitated so grisly. I think it's just a killer sequence at this film.
Yeah, it's really great. I really love that. I really love that bit. And like, even down to when she comes down the stairs and like the candles come on, that was shot in reverse. That like all it is them blowing out the candles. Mm. And then just putting it in reverse, like, to, and it's something creepy about, it's just like, yeah, this, like, and the costume she's in as well. She almost looks like a lizard with that kind of big like wreath around in it. And I know that Sadie Frost kind of had like other ideas for how she wanted Lucy to move when she was kind of in a vampiric state, but like the costume didn't allow for it. Like she'd been doing training with like gymnasts to kind of walk kind of like backwards, almost like how the brides of Frankenstein, the brides of Dracula move, in the way that they're kind of, you know, like they're all kind of contortion, like, yeah, move like contortionists and stuff like that, and like limbs and all stuff like that. She kind of wanted to move in that way, but I think it's still effective. I think she's kind of yeah. What do you make of Lucy Frost? Lucy Frost, Sadie Frost in this. Obviously, she's kind of interesting. She gets to all caps act, I think, in this film, and it's really fun.
All caps act is a good way to put it. It's I think she fits the role well, because as she's in her human form, I believe she's described as the essentially the rich friend who has no filter. So she's always essentially trying to woo these men, while Mina is just like, oh goodness gracious.
Yes.
But and oh, I'm just a bit. My mind's stuck on her saying, I'm almost 20, I'm practically a hag. And here I am a week from turning 30, and I'm just like, fuck you.
Yeah, I guess that was a sign of the times, right? They all lived a lot less. So it's kind of like that.
Yeah,
that was basically middle age in those days.
Oh dear God!
If you weren't married at 14, you're a nobody. yeah, no. She's. I love the kind of like, because it's through her we get introduced to that like kind of rabble of suitors she has. So we have what, Jack Seward, Lord Arthur Holmwood, and Quincy P. Morris. There's kind of that become like a weird like ragtag band, like even though they're kind of, I don't know, the dynamic, like it really works, but the kind of way that they've come together is like, oh, you were all kind of vying for the attention of this one woman, yet like you're all like best buddies all of a sudden. Like I really like it, and I really like their kind of chemistry as a trio, and then obviously as a four piece when Van Helsing gets involved. I think I love their aspect of it, and like let's have a little chat about Richard E. Grant. And I think within this we can kind of talk about those like asylum sequences and talk about Tom Waits as Renfield. Like what are your feelings and thoughts of Richard E. Grant and that I don't know, the kind of the feelings you get from inside that asylum, because it's really like, I don't know, it's creepy and kind of cool in a way.
Oh, I love the way the asylum is designed, particularly the people working there have those boxes on their head as though it's like to stop their faces from getting attacked by the inmates, I guess. But Richard E. Grant is an interesting performance. It's when he's around Lucy, he's a bit clumsy. He's a bit not sure of himself. And inside the asylum, he's essentially the key figure who's going up to Renfield and being like, "Oh, they're gonna have to design a whole new ranking of madness for you." Just feels so, he's relishing his position in that place, and
what? I do, well, he's a morphine like addict as well, right?
Camaraderie of yeah, that's true. They have that one scene where he's shooting up.
Yeah. So like he's like off his nut, and I kind of like, I love his like skittish energy he has through it. Like, do you know what I mean? He's kind of like, especially in those scenes in the asylum, like the way he's shot and he's kind of like big bulging eyes. And like when he's talking to Renfrew, he's like, oh, fascinating. And he's like, what about spiders? Spiders eat the flies. Oh, what about sparrows? And like Renfrew's like, yeah, something, but what about something bigger? Something bigger. And he's like, oh. And yeah, Tom Waits is Renfrew, right? He kind of knocks it out of the park. Like that shot when you first see him and that kind of overhead, like high angle shot and him kind of talking to Dracula, like, my work here is done, like as this kind of like stooge for Dracula, I think is like is fantastic.
Oh, he's Tom Waits is exceptional as Renfield. It just that little rasp of master, and he's just excellent. And I kind of wish we saw a bit more of him, but at the same time, I'm glad for what we did see because it feels like a perfect just beginning, middle and end to his character's story.
Definitely. And yeah, I think we'll see more of the Renfield character next year when we get the Christopher Ooh. Holt starring Renfield film, which stars my boy Nicolas Cage as Count Dracula. So we'll get more Renfield. I'm trying to think of any other moments. Something I love about this, I love the stuff in the castle, and I think some of that is like it feels like it's a chance for them to really like mess around with some of the kind of effects work they were doing, whether it is the shadow play. Like the shadow play especially is great, where Dracula's shadow moves independently of him, and it's so easily done. They just had like another guy kind of in an approximation of the outfit, not in the full prosthetics, but do you know what I mean? Like a kind of hat on and like fingers and a cloak, and could like do this stuff. And it's just really unsettling and creepy. And Francis Ford Coppola said as well, like, he wanted the kind of costumes to be like, he called them the jewels of the film. And he kind of like spent a lot of the budget on that. And I think like it very cleverly, like it just draws so much of your attention, and they very cleverly light certain like sets and stuff like that, that you don't need a lot of the set. Do you know what I mean? Like there'll be moments where like you'll be on a set, but then just a whole wall is just shrouded into darkness. And it's like, for them, they're like, oh, we don't have to worry about that part of the set whatsoever. We'll just kind of worry about this part we've got. And then like your eye is drawn to, yeah, like Gary Oldman in that kimono and the booby hair. Do you know what I mean?
I know it's such a great set. It's fantastic, and it's also offset by how just simply the laws of physics are all messed up, because Dracula's just using telekinetic abilities, whether it's shattering mirrors or knocking over the ink or shutting the door. And then you've got, his shadow's acting independently, and you got liquid dripping upwards. You just know something's off kilter. And it also feels like the walls are closing in on Jonathan Harker as he's in the middle of that.
There's that moment when it's a moment when Jonathan's creeping around the castle, and he's on the outside of it, like scaling something, and he falls sideways. And it's like the castle itself. And even when you see the silhouette of the castle from a distance, it looks like a man sat on a throne, like an old decrepit man sat on a throne. And it's like really interesting. Like the castle itself feels like a character. Do you know what I mean? It's living, it's breathing, and it's kind of... I love that aspect of this film, that it's like, I don't know. Yeah. Again, it comes back to that thing that it feels like everything is servicing the film itself. And I think it plays into the vampiric lore, right? In the fact that They need the earth from where they live to kind of like sustain and stuff like that. In the basement, they're kind of carting out all the Transylvanian earth to keep him alive when he's in London and stuff like that.
No, exactly. And it feels like there's no escape for Jonathan in that, not even in his room, because when he's shaving and you got that phenomenal scene where you see him in the mirror, but Dracula's hand's reaching behind him and there's no reflection being cast in the mirror. It's a great little sequence. Also, fun fact, the person whose back you see is Johnny Knoxville.
No, what? Because that's done with a double as set.
As in Keanu's, they did Terminator 2'd it, where the mirror image is the actual actor, and got the double to face their back to it.
Yeah,
that was the Jackass star.
Amazing. I love that. That's got to be on the IMDb trivia. I must have skimmed over that. That's amazing. Oh, wicked.
I learned that from the Empire podcast, actually.
Oh, is that one of their useless facts or whatever they call it?
When they were doing the free fact structure, yeah.
Okay. We've touched upon the castle. Is there kind of, I don't know, is there any aspects of this film that we've kind of missed? I obviously feel like we should definitely one shout out the costume design, or the designer on this film, Eiki Ishito, who kind of like the way I would kind of position her in this film, she's almost like how Giga created just the kind of like aesthetic and like visual language of Alien. It's like that's kind of what she did with this film. It's like it's like she kind of led the charge of like, I'm going to design these costumes, and it's like everything else will fall in place after that. It felt like a real kind of tone setter. Do you know what I mean? And like kind of like the things they were drawing upon. I know that Coppola had kind of seen her because she was the art director on Mishima, A Story in Three Chapters, and had handled the Japanese poster for Apocalypse Now as well. And they had discussions and he showed her a Klimt painting called The Kiss quite early on. And she was like, there's something in that I see that's really interesting. And she said, like, it was this idea of almost like East meets West. And that's kind of like where they went with a lot of like the production, especially with Dracula and stuff like that, and the stuff he wears, especially like at the end where he's kind of got that almost like a high priest robe that's kind of like looks like it's made out of like different squares and stuff like that. Like that itself feels like, if you ever see like a Klimt painting, it's very much looks like that kind of, like robe that he wears then. I don't know, what kind of costume pieces like really like burn a hole in your brain, James?
Well, I'm going to be basic as fuck, but I'm going to go for Dracula's red kimono for when he's in the castle, he's old, and just that simple image of Keanu and Gary Oldman walking and the long trail being left by the kimono. It feels like through it all, it's not trying to be of a specific to anything. It just feels like it's own way of signifying it's this one-of-a-kind world, it's this one-of-a-kind vision that's being brought together just for this film, and it feels very much just vital to this film to give it, breathe it alive, and to just give it, it's a part of its own identity, really.
Yeah, and I think that kimono really speaks to something that she talked about with how she wanted Dracula to look, especially when he was a vampire and kind of like on home soil, as it were. She kind of wanted like a gender and kind of just an overall ambiguity to Dracula. Like, do you know what I mean? It's like, it's kind of austere and like there's a masculine quality to it, but there's also there's a femininity to it with the big like train behind it and stuff. And it's kind of like, and she kind of like, it kind of gets that thing of Dracula just being ambiguous, not like kind of out of the realms of gender or sexuality or anything like that, just ambiguous as to like even being human. Do you know what I mean? Obviously he's not, like he's this otherworldly creature, but I think she captures that in the costume design, and I think Coppola made a real good choice by making that a focal point, and kind of, I don't know, it kind of makes this film theatrical yet filmic at the same time, and kind of sounds like he had it really planned out of like, and even the way, like, obviously, yeah, everyone else is kind of dressed in like just period setting attire, but there's just choices in like colors and stuff like that, like with Sadie Frost as Lucy, like her costumes just keep getting like more vibrant, you know, like when she has that scene where she like has sex with the kind of beast wolfman like Dracula, like she's in like this orange, and then like there's a moment when she's like writhing around on the bed and she's all in the red and stuff like that, whereas Mina's colors are very like pale and muted, and her costuming is very, yeah, like signifies the character. It's very conservative, high necks and very tight and like highly strung, like the almost like the character herself. It's all kind of virginal, whereas yeah, Lucy is like very like, oh, out there. Do you know what I mean? Her green, which is like my snake dress and stuff like that. It's very like breasty, and Sadie Frost is very breasty throughout this film. It kind of seems like every other scene she's like kind of having a wardrobe malfunction and we're seeing a bit of tit. So as for other aspects of this film, yeah, what have we missed, James? Like, I feel like we're gonna do this film a disservice because you could dedicate hours upon hours discussing this film and not even scratch the surface. So an hour and a half probably isn't enough time, but we can't be here all night, let's be honest.
Yeah, I feel like we could just keep picking out items to talk about just from like the way from Lucy's death and how it intercuts with Mina's marriage. And just the way it goes so theatrical with the blood at the end, as though The Shining is trying to make a cameo appearance.
Yes.
But it just feels like we're always going to find something, and because there's so much to talk about this film, it feels like it begs you to look deeper and to just keep looking and looking, because Francis and all involved just kept putting so much to bring alive this story in a way that sets it apart so much, considering it's about a character that's been adapted hundreds of times in so many different forms.
So I've got to ask you this. Is this film like a... is it a romance story kind of tricking us by using genre trappings? Like, is it kind of what it sets out to be? Is it a kind of, is it a horror, or is this something else entirely?
I think it works as both a horror and a romance film. I mean, you said, is it a romance film that's trying to trick us into thinking it's horror? But which, yeah, you could say that for horror fans, but I think you could also say the opposite. You could say it's a horror film trying to pose itself as a romance film and to get interested the people who probably wouldn't be so interested in a horror film. And I know people who are like, oh, this film was my identity in my teens. And I'm sure they would have latched onto the romance aspects but they could have latched onto the horror aspects. I think it does so well in both elements, and it just, well, really satisfies either audience.
Yeah, I think it's a film that kind of rightfully has kind of been reevaluated, and kind of people who maybe have seen it when they're younger. I think a lot of it, like, is quite kind of interesting. I listened a while ago now to Mike Munter from The Evolution of Horror discuss this film. And he talked about, like, the fact of the first time him seeing it, and kind of like the romance stuff was a bit like seeing it as a teenage boy. It was a bit like, oh, not for me. But then, like, as he's got older, like, really loves it. And it's kind of like that thing of, like, yeah, you can imagine, like, teenage boys being like, oh, I thought it was going to be all just blood and guts and stuff like that. And it's kind of, as you kind of mature, it's like, this is, I don't, this guy sounds very, like, a high-minded and very, I don't know, direct statement, but this film to me feels like cinema. Do you know what I mean? This feels like, this is filmmaking, and it's, I love it for that. I love that, like, you could see the filmmaking at work, but it doesn't, like, it's not a thing of, like, it takes you out of it. It's like, oh, this is just adding to the mood and the textuality of this film to make it, like, so great, and brings all the parts to make the sum really great and fun. And that is a thing I don't think we've said about this film, is it's fun. It's 2 hours, moves along at a clip, and I watched it earlier today in preparation for this conversation, and I'm not lying to you, I could happily, and I'm half tempted to, when we jump off of this Zoom call, to fucking watch it again. Like, I like, because it's just, there's so much to feast upon this film, pun intended.
I don't blame you. It feels like the kind of film that keeps on giving. It's, I wasn't well on Monday, and just to recuperate, I thought, why don't I just watch Dracula again? And I absolutely loved revisiting it, especially so soon after seeing it in the cinema. It just felt like coming back to an old friend, and I just getting myself lost in the gorgeousness of it all, from visuals to sound to the gorgeous people. I mean, let's be honest.
Oh, yeah. It's a sexy cast. You mentioned sound there, and for somebody who loves music, I always forget to mention the scores to these films, but the score to this by, I'm going to butcher this name, but Wojciech Kilar, Polish composer, is absolutely phenomenal. Like, it sounds like a found piece of music. Like, the music sounds like they've kind of, I don't know, pulled something from the late 1800s or something like that. It's gothic, and it's kind of like that kind of, like, main theme for the film. It's just like, oh, just yes, please. Like, inject it into my ears. Like, I absolutely love it. And it's kind of, it's of a piece. Like, I'm not sure how do you feel about, there's like a needle drop track during the credits. What did you catch that when you're in the cinema? I believe it's like what is her name? Why can't I think of her name? Annie Lennox? The Annie Lennox track. What did you make of that? Because I feel like the film up until that point kind of holds a tone and feels like a film out of time, whereas when that track comes in, I'm kind of a bit like, oh, I kind of wish I'd like, I like when I watch it on DVD now, or yeah, Blu-ray, I kind of turn it off before that track. I like the song itself, but in the kind of experience of the film, I kind of, I'm like, no, I kind of want this to feel old timey.
I'll be honest, I haven't actually listened to it. It's when I saw the film in cinemas, I was just there listening the old-timey music as the credits played, and I was just like, okay, I want to sit in this, but I really need a Wii. And then after the what I watched it at home, I didn't know about the Annie Lennox song until like earlier today when I was doing a bit of research. I was like, oh, I should probably have a listen to it. And I never did, because I guess I'm a professional, but not that professional, I guess. But yeah, I can't comment on that song. Sorry.
Nice. It is all right. So this film was nominated for 4 Academy Awards. Do you know how many Academy Awards this film won, James? Without looking. Don't look. I'm going to text you if you don't know. Do you know off the top of your head, yes or no?
Yes, because my DVD says.
Oh, yes. So this film was nominated for 4. So best costume design, best sound editing, best makeup, and best art direction. And won 3 of those awards. So won best costume, best sound, and best makeup. All rightfully as well, right?
Absolutely.
Like,
it's a bit of a cliche, like, you don't nominate the genre film for much other than technical, but this really deserved the technical awards.
Oh, what? Yeah. I'm not sure what it would have been up against for best art direction without kind of like stalling this at that time, but I bet you it's not a film that we talk about to this day. Do you know what I mean? Like,
it lost to Howard's End.
There you go.
So yeah, I don't really hear a lot of talk about Howard's End. So yeah, I suppose so.
There you go. But then, yeah. Howard's End was probably going to win because it is a period drama. They seem to be a shoo-in for those kind of awards, even though Bram Stoker's Dracula could be argued is a period drama, is a horror, is a romantic tale, is a kind of melange of high camp goodness that that makes such a fun film. So, yeah, is there anything we've missed? Obviously, there's inevitably going to be stuff that we've missed with this film, James. But is there anything that's kind of burning in your brain that needs to get out before we start to make our way out of Transylvania and try and get back to London?
I don't think so. What about you? Do you have anything in particular?
No, there's nothing. There's not, like, I'm sure I'll be woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning, just drenched in sweat, filled with regret of like, I should have mentioned that. but that is my life as a whole anyway. So before I get to that point in my life, there's a few things we need to do before we go. And the first one is,
yes,
did you manage to find any Coppola connections within this film? Is there people who worked in front of or behind the camera who worked with the Coppolas elsewhere in their filmography? James, did you manage to find any?
I found one, but it's tenuous. It's going full 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon on it.
Let's do it.
Okay, so this film stars Anthony Hopkins and Gary Oldman, both Oscar winners. And they won Oscars for playing Hannibal Lecter and Winston Churchill, roles which were previously inhabited, not to an Oscar nomination, by Brian Cox. And Brian Cox, as we all know, stars in Succession, and he has many children vying to succeed him in that show, including Roman, played by Kieran Culkin. Now, I first became aware of Kieran Culkin during a very memorable turn in Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, where the main villain was played by Jason Schwartzman.
You know what? You could have got there quicker. You could. Brian Cox as well. Brian Cox is also in Rushmore as the principal of Rushmore Academy, and is in Adaptation with Nicolas Cage. So there you go. There's my kind of beautiful mind brain working all the time. I'll read off the couple of connections I've got here. There's some obvious one. Fred Roos, who's a producer on this film, is a longtime producing partner with Francis Ford Coppola. That's kind of by the by. So Winona Ryder plays Kim in Edward Scissorhands, which Stephanie Schwartzman was the art department researcher for. Keanu Reeves is in Between Two Ferns, the movie, as is Jason Schwartzman. Cary Elwes dipped his toe back into the world of vampires by featuring in the film Shadow of the Vampire, which stars Willem Dafoe and John Malkovich, which I believe is about the making of Nosferatu, but is actually produced, one of the rare times that he's produced a film and is not in the film, by Nicolas Cage. Tom Waits is in five other Francis Ford Coppola films and provides music for the film One from the Heart. Storyboard artist Peter Ramsey, who I mentioned earlier, actually went on to be one of several directors of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which obviously Nicolas Cage plays Spider-Man Noir. And Monica Bellucci, who plays one of Dracula's wives, is in The Sorcerer's Apprentice and appears in one season of Mozart in the Jungle, which is created by Jason Schwartzman and Roman Coppola. That is all I've got for Cope Connections for this week. I'm sure there's more, but time is fleeting, and sometimes I cannot click on every single one person's name on IMDb because I need to live a life, guys. If you've got any, hit me up. Caged in Pod on all the social medias. Come on. So let's get to rating this film, James. And the way that we do this here is we ask, what would be the perfect wine pairing for this film?
I'm glad that's a rating thing rather than actual wine recommendation, because I am shit at that. But let me say, you are getting the bloodiest of red wine to watch this film, and you are absolutely paying top shelf.
Lovely stuff.
Deserves it.
Yes, this is a top shelf film. This is almost a vintage. Do you know what I mean? This is, if I was in a restaurant, I would be happy to turn over that page on the wine menu, because this has got some lovely kind of, this is full bodied. This has got like kind of, I don't know, a sweet yet bitter aftertaste that you kind of can't get enough of. And that kind of is this film. It's kind of, there's a sweetness to it. There's a hard, sharp edge to it. And you kind of, I don't know, you keep wanting to go back for another glass. I think that's a way that you would describe Bram Stoker's Dracula. So let me ask you, James, based on this film alone, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time? You got two of the Coppolas kind of stepping up to the mark here. You've got kind of Roman Coppola, like, coming in kind of last minute, having like Francis having like arguments with the effects departments about like, no, that's not how I want it, kind of, and then kind of really pulling the bag out to get all those kind of like practical effects like done so well and kind of nailing it. And obviously you've got Francis at the helm of this. Surely is that enough to mark them as the greatest film fan of all time?
I mean, if you're going by one film, this is a damn good one to base it off of. If they're not the greatest film family of all time on the basis of this film, they're a damn strong contender for it.
Okay. There's a bit politician, a bit diplomatic there, but I'm going to take that as a yes, James.
Oh,
I'm
absolutely.
So let me ask you this. Which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the entire filmography of the rest of the family?
This is a tough one. I'd honestly, look, Francis has made some of the greatest films of all time. But for me, Nicolas Cage has been a part of films that are so personal to me and mean the world. And I cannot fathom losing the likes of Mandy, Pig, Raising Arizona, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. I gotta go for Nicolas Cage, in all honesty. Sorry, Francis, but I need Spider-Man Noir and Red over Renfield.
That is absolutely fine. Like, I ain't gonna argue with that. Nicolas Cage is a great choice, and I like your rationale. Sometimes you've got to be selfish with these. Mm-hmm. Some people think about the mark on Hollywood history, but it's what your heart tells you, and that's where you went, and that's what I respect. That's what I respect. Any previous guests who are listening who went for the went for the mark on Hollywood, fuck you. All right, I'm saying. Yeah, no. I'm joking. I love you all. But
I don't.
Whoa. On that bombshell, I need to ask you possibly the most important question on this podcast. What does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
I think he says, "Hey, Mambo, Mambo Italiano."
Hey, Coco. Yes. And then they boogie off into the night and they never see each other again. I think, yeah.
Hell of a goodbye.
That's great. Yeah. I think you might have nailed it there. I think the lip readers and the, do you know what? You might have nailed it there, James. So let me ask you. Why am I acting like there's another question on this? Before I let you go, obviously, you're podcasting. You're always writing stuff about films. Where's the best place to keep up to date with all of that? Obviously you appear on a lot of podcasts as well. So yeah, where's the best place for people to keep up to date with what you're doing and where to find everything you're doing?
Well, thanks for having me on. Thanks to anybody who listens to me. If I haven't put you off from listening to more of me or following me, I'm over at Twitter and Letterboxd at RoddersJ04. That's spelled with two Ds. And I write reviews at thereviewingrodders.co.uk. I also put any podcast appearances or articles I write or whatever on there. So yeah, come check it out. And have a happy Halloween.
Ooh, well, thank you so much for coming and making some Coppola connections with me, James.
Anytime.
It's okay. We could just do this for eternity, right?
See, imagine if Gary Oldman had said, "I crossed oceans of time to find you."
There we have it, guys. Another film down. Another vote for yes for the Coppolas being the greatest film family of all time. A massive thank you once again to James Rodriguez for joining me. And a massive thank you for you for listening. Remember that love never dies, as do the Coppola family. I'm sure I'll be covering this family long into my twilight years. If only I had immortality so I could cover this family forever and ever until the sun burns out and we all die. As for next week on the podcast, I'll be talking to Kevin Lehane, one half of the excellent Best Bits podcast and a screenwriter in his own right, to discuss the 1992, again, we're sticking in 1992, the John Carpenter Memoirs of an Invisible Man, which Stephanie Schwartzman was the art department researcher. Oh yeah, that's how granular we get on this podcast. We look at people who are part of the Kobler family who do very small, insular, tiny, minuscule roles to get the length and breadth of this family's mark on Hollywood. I'm sure if you listen to this podcast before, you would know that's how granular we go. Sometimes we cover films that we find out don't actually have a Coppola connection at all. There is just some false information on Wikipedia or IMDb. But there we go. That's how we roll here. If you'd like to get in touch with me, the podcast, you can do so at CagedInPod on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, and TikTok. Or you can drop me an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. And if you'd like to give me a little bit of money and support the podcast, you can do so over at patreon.com/cagedinpod. Or you can rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now. So as ever, guys, I've been Petra Patsilos, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.